Welcome again. Glad to have you here. This is part two of two parts. And as I said yesterday, I didn't know how far we would get yesterday. But basically, for those of you who weren't able to be here yesterday, hi, Juanita. Good to see you. Those of you who weren't able to be here yesterday, the overview is that I provided several preliminary kinds of perspectives on preaching and teaching James, and then was going to give three examples of themes to preach or teach on from the book of James. And that's where we're at right now. So we'll look at the second sample here, if you will, of a theme that really weaves all the way through James. So these are ones that are really dominant themes, dominant subjects that he comes back to. And James is basically made up of a series of discourses. And scholars have, at one time, scholars felt that it was the structure, organization was quite chaotic. That has changed, and they now see that there is organization, there is a strategy and a connection, but often scholars are not together on what that strategy or that relationship is. But because of the individual discourses, I think one way in which to approach the book of James is to look at these dominant themes, and so these are samples that I give. And then following that, depending on the time, we will look at least one and hopefully two of specific texts. And then just five in the remainder of time that we have, if we have about 5 minutes, I want to briefly go over a bibliography that might be of help for further study. And I have a hard copy to hand out of that bibliography, and I'll point out some things that I think are especially helpful in studying the book of James. Yesterday, the first theme that we looked at was character formation through endurance. Looked at that very first section in James where he says, whenever you face trials of any kind, consider it nothing but joy because you know that the testing of your faith produces endurance, and let endurance have its full effect so that you may be mature and complete, lacking in nothing. That's a theme that's woven all the way through the book of James. The second one that I want to look at now is this next one that is also a thread through the whole letter, and that is the idea of genuine faith. Let me read some of these passages to get just to get a flavor. This isn't inclusive, but it at least gives you a flavor of how this is spread throughout James, this genuine faith. And as Willie Holcomb yesterday asked the question, and he was obviously familiar with this issue of what's James' relationship to Paul. That used to be a big deal of how James is related to Paul. Anymore, that really has been pushed to the side because James is not trying to come up against Paul and correct Paul or emphasize something that Paul he didn't feel had emphasized enough. James is his own person, and James said yesterday that there are more imperatives in the book of James than in any other book in the Bible, and that for some people is a real negative. And I've mentioned that some people think that when they're reading James, it's like taking a long road trip with their mom because it's all these do's and don'ts and yeses and nos and all this kind of advice. But James assumes the gospel story, and he's building on that, and he's building on the Sermon on the Mount. He is reappropriating. Without quoting, except one time, he's reappropriating the Sermon on the Mount in a new context, which is really a sign of mature wisdom. James is a type of wisdom book. Genuine faith is a faith that is active. And so you have all of these imperatives throughout the book. And let's read just a couple of samples here to get started on this. The first one is chapter 1, verse 22, where he says, "But be doers of the word, and not merely hearers who deceive themselves. For if any are hearers of the word and not doers, they are like those who look at themselves in a mirror. For they look at themselves and on going away immediately forget what they look like. But those who look into the perfect law, the law of liberty, and persevere," there's that endurance theme again. I mean, you can pick these themes up all the way through. "And persevere, being not hearers who forget, but doers who act, they will be blessed in their doing. If any think they are religious and do not bridle their tongue, but deceive their hearts, their religion is worthless." So you hear this theme of genuine faith, being doers of the word. Chapter 2, verse 14, I'm not going to read this whole section, but 2:14, where he gives this example of those who say, you know, go in peace, be warmed and be filled, but they don't do anything about it. Faith, verse 17, by itself, if it has no works, is dead. That's genuine faith. Genuine faith that expresses itself in action. And then chapter 3, verse 13, I take this, as I said yesterday, as really a pretty good way to summarize the message of James. "Who is wise and understanding among you? Show by your good life that your works are done with gentleness, born of wisdom." And then chapter 4, verse 17, one more here, at least as a sample. There could be a number of others as well. "Anyone then who knows the right thing to do and fails to do it commits sin." So you see this thread, and I think that would be a really good way of approaching the book of James, to look at this theme and to develop it, unpack it, to show how this then works in our lives. So James really, again, is very much in line with the Sermon on the Mount. You remember how the Sermon on the Mount concludes. "Everyone who hears and acts on them will be like a wise man who built his house on a rock." So James obviously is really very much about emphasizing doing, the putting flesh, if you will, on one's faith. And it really is easy to deceive ourselves about believing that our faith is genuine. Here's just a little description, or maybe just a brief phrase of how James puts this all the way through. As we just read, he says, "Don't just hear the word, but do it. Don't just say you believe, but prove it. Don't just claim to understand the word, but show it. And don't just know to do good, do it." Again, all the way through, he is emphasizing this. A couple of examples here that might help expand this, help put this in more in light of our own contemporary responsibilities. We have a lot of sayings, as you know, that deal with, this kind of thing. "Who you are, speak so loudly, I can't hear what you say." "Actions speak louder than words." "I understand," this is from secondhand knowledge, but in the race world in California, there's this saying that somebody is all go and no show. You know, or in Texas, some of you are familiar with Texas saying, it's they would say all hat and no cattle, you know, big talker. And did any of you hear tokens last Tuesday night? Anybody here? Okay, brother preacher, I can see or imagine brother preacher saying something like, you know, he who talks by the yard but walks by the inch ought to be kicked by the foot. You know, that would be what brother preacher would say, and that would be in a surface way what James is saying. There's this little parable that Soren Kierkegaard tells. He says there was a man who escaped from an insane asylum, and he really didn't want to be discovered, and so he thought that if he could come up with something to say that would disguise his insanity, something that he knew everyone would believe and could not disagree with him on, then he would be safe. And so he settled on, the world is round. And so everyone he met, he said, the world is round, the world is round. And in a short while, he was discovered and taken back to the insane asylum. And the point of the parable is that the truth in the mouth of someone who hasn't been shaped by it is ridiculous. And that's what James really emphasizes all the way through. There's another, to give you another little example here, maybe to try to look at ways of bringing this point out. And this comes from something that Stephen Covey had written. He says in one of his books, and actually this is the son of Stephen Covey Sr., says in one of his books that in terms of talking about righting wrongs, when you do something wrong, how do you right a wrong? Do you just say, I'm sorry, and then kind of go on your way? Well, he makes this little principle statement, and the principle is you can't talk your way out of wrongdoing. You behave your way out of wrongdoing. And I like that. Now, I know that there are certain wrongdoings that we cannot undo. I know that. But overall, that is a, I would say, something that James would be able to affirm. So this is, this comes from a book by James Coonan. It's a little statement that I really like. He says, it's a God day today. Everybody makes the worship scene for an hour and comes out feeling good. That's the trouble. They should come out feeling like doing good, but instead they feel good already without doing anything. That's where we really, it's very easy to deceive ourselves in thinking, you know, we come out feeling good, and that feeling good then it kind of replaces doing good. Okay, I feel good, so things must be all right. James would be one who is adamantly opposed to that perspective on life. Just a few, then, just those are just a few examples of what might be helpful to put some flesh on, contemporary flesh anyway, on this theme of genuine faith. This passage, again, a very key passage in James at the end of chapter 1, really describes the marks of a genuine faith. And that is someone who is controls the tongue. When James says there in verse 26, if anyone think they are religious and do not bridle their tongue but deceive their hearts, their religion is worthless. And in this same passage, care for orphans is another way of describing or demonstrating genuine faith. Religion that is pure and undefiled before God the Father is this, to care for the orphans and widows in their distress, and, he says, to keep oneself unstained by the world. So these kinds of things, learning to control our speech, reaching out to the marginal, and one's personal character, character formation. And as I argued yesterday, I feel that that is really the fundamental component of this book, of this letter, and that is James is most concerned about one's character and character formation, shaping one's character, maturing in character. And when a character is on the road to maturing, then everything else falls into place. One's speech, reaching out to the poor, and being respectful of others, all of those things then fall into place. All right, that is the second example. Here's the third and final example I would like to give, and that is there is this theme all through James about respecting others, regardless of status, or wealth, or whatever. Respect for all, and just a few examples here that you can see. Let me. We've already read 1:26-27, and that is the concern for the poor and the widows. In 2:1-7, that's the passage that Dusty Rush. Did any of you hear Dusty the other night? That was really good. He did a outstanding job about ushering 101. And how we, you know, how we look at others around us, especially those who are not like us or who may not have our economic or social status. How we look at those. Chapter 4, 11 and 12. Do not speak evil against one another, brothers and sisters. Whoever speaks evil against another or judges another speaks evil against the law and judges the law. But if you judge the law, you are not a doer of the law, but a judge. There is one lawgiver and judge who is able to save and destroy. So who then are you to judge your neighbor? Again, this idea of respect for all. Whoever your neighbor is, the respect for that other individual is a thread all the way through James. And then 5:1-6, as Sarah Barton dealt with yesterday in a wonderful way. The rich who are taking, the merchants who are taking advantage of those workers, those laborers, showing total disregard for their well-being. So this whole thread is woven all through the book. And again, I feel a really appropriate topic or theme to develop in a sermon or a class or in whatever setting you might be teaching. So here, just a list here, at least a partial list of those that we are to respect. Widows and orphans, poor in your assembly, respectfully speaking of all people, regardless of the injustices committed against laborers and those of lower status by those who are wealthy. Here's some specific ways, again, trying to put some flesh on this, at least contemporary flesh. James does a pretty good job of putting flesh on this. Some specific ways that we can consider showing respect to others. And this comes, as I mentioned up there, as I put on the slide, comes from Stephen Covey's Speed of Trust. Any of you familiar with this book? Okay, it's a very good book. He has he talks about the waiter rule. And this is the waiter rule. If you go into a restaurant and sit down with another person, and that other person is you know, maybe some kind of individual that's trying to persuade you to do something or invest in something or whatever it is, participate in something. And the waiter comes up and that other person talks short or abruptly or disrespectfully or demandingly of the waiter, he says, don't do business with that other person. How we treat those who are in lesser positions, if you will, in our society reflects our character. And if we cannot respect those kinds of individuals, then it is somebody that we should be very wary of. Probably we should also look at ourselves in terms of how we look at those others in service kinds of positions. A second thing that he suggests is that you speak about people as though they were present. And I think back here to what James says in chapter 4 that we read just a moment ago. Verse 11, do not speak evil against one another, brothers or sisters. Whoever speaks evil against another or judges another speaks evil against the law and judges the law. So speak about people as though they were present. Now, that does not mean that what we say about somebody else, if we are in a church context and trying to discern whether this individual is best for this position or what limitations they have, what strengths they have. That doesn't mean that we have to ignore the limitations, not at all. But in talking about those limitations, we talk respectfully about those limitations that is in their best interest. I think it's a good principle to follow. And a third one, and that is, give credit to others. This is a great way of showing respect and honor to others. So, in the church, when you accomplish something and it is successful, then Covey talks about the mirror window analogy. He says, when you do something and it's successful, then look through the window and see who it was who helped that project become a success and give them credit. That's the window side. If the particular event or project or ministry didn't work, was a failure, then look in the mirror and take responsibility for that failure or for the limitations of what were a part of the situation. I think that's a really good way. It's really this whole thing about credit. You know, we think that, and we do live in a culture of limited resources, and in terms of natural resources, and we impose that. We take those limited resources and we impose them on spiritual resources. And so we think, if I give somebody else credit, that takes away from my credit. That depletes my credit that I deserve. And so we oftentimes are really hesitant to give other people in the church credit just because of that. Now, we may not express it that way. We may find ways around that. But that's a pretty common perspective to have. If I give somebody else credit, it takes away from mine. The analogy I like to use is that of a candle. When you have a candle, and then you light another candle, and another candle, and another candle, it does not deplete the flame on that initial candle. It just becomes brighter. And that's what happens when you give others credit, when you really honor others and show them respect. There are many different ways that we can dishonor and dismiss and be disrespectful of others. It may be because of a job position that they're in, economic position they're in. It may be because of physical traits. It may be because of attractiveness or unattractiveness. Some of these things we don't like to talk about. I would like to bring up this the whole thing of respect regarding attractiveness, because it's a very common way of disrespecting others. And how many of you seen the movie Tootsie? I mean, it's way back. For those of you who haven't, it's about a man who, Dustin Hoffman, who dresses up like a woman. And I can't even remember why he does that.
He was attracted to another girl, so he wanted to be her friend.
Okay, yeah. Thank you. Attracted to another girl, he wants to be her friend, and so he plays this part in, what is it, some kind of
Soap opera.
He was
an actor, yep. And he couldn't get a job as a man, but he could get the role as a woman. Yes.
Thank you. Okay, he got the role as a woman.
And he kind of fell in love with that girl, but it wasn't.
Yeah.
Okay.
That was the complexity part of it.
Okay. Movie. Good. Good. Thank you. This is an interview by Dustin Hoffman that I thought was really revealing, and so I wanted to share it here.
Murray Schisgal, who has been my dear friend for over 30 years, kicked off Tootsie with the thought of how would you be different if you had been born a woman? So in a conversation we had one time. Not what does it feel like to be a woman, because all sexes have asked themselves the question, what does it feel like to be, what would it feel like to be the opposite sex? But his question was different. If you were born a woman, how would you be different? So that kicked off, it would take too long to answer how we then got involved in Tootsie for about 2 years before we even got a director, just working on different drafts of the script. But I did go to Columbia and I asked them if they would spend the money to do makeup tests so that I could look like a woman. And if I couldn't look like a woman, they would agree not to make the movie. And they said, what do you mean? And I just somehow intuitively felt that unless I could walk down the streets of New York and not have dressed as a woman and not have people turn and say, who's that guy in drag? Or turn for any reason, that, you know, who's that freak? Unless I could do that, I didn't want to make the film. I didn't want the audience to suspend their believability. When we got to that point, and looked at it on screen, I was shocked that I wasn't more attractive. And I said, now you have me looking like a woman, now make me a beautiful woman. Because I thought I should be beautiful. If I was going to be a woman, I would want to be as beautiful as possible. And they said to me, that's as good as it gets. Beautiful as we can get you, Charlie. And it was at that moment that I had an epiphany, and I went home and started crying, talking to my wife, and I said, I have to make this picture. And she said, why? And I said, because I think I'm an interesting woman when I look at myself on screen, and I know that if I met myself at a party, I would never talk to her, that character, because she doesn't fulfill physically the demands that we're brought up to think women have to have in order for us to ask them out. She says, what are you saying? And I said, there's too many interesting women. I have not had the experience to know in this life because I have been brainwashed, and that was never a comedy for me.
I think that's a pretty powerful testimony. Mm-hmm. There are many different ways that we can show disrespect to others, and sometimes we're not even aware of it. and to be more sensitive, attuned, self-reflective on how we are relating to others is critical. James is very concerned about that. Regardless of social status, economic status, appearance, physical appearance, job, lifestyle, regardless, he is demanding that we respect all. All right, those are the three themes that I wanted to look at. Now, at least we'll have time for, I do want to have time for a little Q&A, and also just not just necessarily Q&A, but just participation and other insights. But I do want to at least look at one specific text and work through that in terms of preaching and teaching this material. And the one I want to look at is the very familiar one in James chapter 3, the one about the tongue. So I'm going to read this, make some comments, observations, and then hopefully some insights that might continue to expand this in our contemporary setting. He begins, verse 1, "Not many of you should become teachers, my brothers and sisters, for you know that we who teach will be judged with greater strictness." Now, he is, who James is talking about in terms of teachers is not necessarily, at least initially here, it is not necessarily Bible class teachers. It is more professional kinds of teachers. And if you look through all the New Testament and those lists of gifts that are there in the New Testament, in Corinthians and Romans and Timothy and Titus and Ephesians, teachers are always ranked up pretty high. And so many scholars believe that these are not just kind of the run-of-mill teachers, but these are special teachers. But at the same time, he's addressing the whole congregation, or at least the whole dispersion, okay? Because he says, he addresses it to brothers and sisters. At least I'm reading the new RSV here. He's addressing it to the whole congregation. And it appears that there were some in the congregation who were, who looked at this position and aspired to be in this position. You know, this was a status type of position, in a sense. And there were some who were aspiring to that position who should not be. And I would stop here and just say this. It's important for us in the congregation, especially as leaders in whatever position that is, to help people realize and understand their gifts and put them in the appropriate position. Or for me or us to ask the question, am I really suited for this ministry position? Or is there another reason that I am aspiring for this position? Am I aspiring for it because it'll give me a little more, I'll get a little more attention, it's a little more of a status type of position that I can get? I think that's important. And James is discouraging people from, you know, from being in positions that they are not suited to be in. Teaching is a very important responsibility, and it's very easy for abuses to occur in that position. We're responsible for speaking the truth faithfully, speaking the truth in love, and faithfully and in love, those are difficult things to do. There's a poem by Elizabeth Browning that I really like, and it goes like this. "Tell all the truth, but tell it slant." Now, by slant, she doesn't mean deceptively. She means at an angle. You know, what is it that this this person or this class needs, but tell all the truth, but tell it slant. Success in circuit lies. In other words, sometimes, now James is pretty direct. I'm not, it depends on who you're with, but again, I'm not sure that James would always be the model that we would follow in terms of just blurting it out. Success in circuit lies, too bright for our infirm delight, the truth superb surprise. So sometimes the truth is so bright that people aren't able to handle it. And then the second stanza goes something like, as lightning to the children eased with explanation kind. In other words, there are some things that are really difficult for children to handle. With lightning to the children ease with explanation kind, the truth must dazzle gradually, or everyone be blind. There is a heavy responsibility that teachers have to know their audience and know the best way in which to communicate that. Verse 2, for all of us make many mistakes, and anyone who makes no mistake makes no mistakes in speaking is perfect, able to keep the whole body in check with a bridle. If we put bits into the mouths of horses, and here he is, let me back up here. Verses 2 through 4, what you have is his description of the ideal control of the tongue. This is when the tongue is under complete control. If we put bits in the mouths of horses to make them obey us, we guide their whole bodies. And notice the contrast between small and large, little and great. So you have a small bit in the mouths of powerful horses. Or at ships, though they are so large that it takes strong winds to drive them, yet they are guided by a very small rudder, wherever the will of the pilot directs. So also the tongue is a small member, but it boasts of great exploits. So this this major contrast, this is where you have the ideal control. If you have these bits and these rudders, if the tongue works like that, then everything's under control. However, verses 5 through 8 is the reality. The reality, and this is where he gets really hard. The reality of that the tongue really can't be controlled. How great is a forest set ablaze by a small fire? And the tongue is a fire. The tongue is, some would say, the reason that this is not an uncommon image to describe the tongue as a fire. And some speculate that that's because the tongue is the same, similar color and shape of a flame. So that's why it oftentimes is related to a fire or a flame. The tongue is placed among our members as a world of iniquity. It stains the whole body. Remember back in chapter 1, verse 27, keep oneself unstained by the world. And so the world has access to our bodies through our tongue. The world can gain access to our whole being through our little tongue. It stains the whole body, sets on fire the cycle, this is my version, the cycle of nature. My understanding here is that basically, you know, in other words, it sets on fire the whole of life, the cycle of nature. And is itself set on fire by hell. Now that's really strong language, isn't it? It stains the whole body. It sets on fire the whole of life. And it is set on fire by hell. That's pretty powerful language. For every species of beasts and birds, of reptiles and sea creatures can be tamed and has been tamed by the human species, but no one can tame the tongue. A restless evil full of deadly poison. And then verses 9 and 10, he gives an example. So verses 2 through 4 is the ideal control of the tongue. Verses 5 through 8, the reality that the tongue can't be controlled.
And then verses 9 and 10, he gives a specific example of it not being controlled. With it, we bless the Lord and Father, and with it, we curse those who are made in the likeness of God. From the same mouth come blessing and cursing. And so here again is this whole image of respect. We curse others who are made in the likeness of God, regardless of status, regardless of physical appearance, regardless of economic situation. From the same mouth come blessing and cursing. My brothers and sisters, so he's talking to the whole congregation, this ought not to be so. And then he concludes by really setting up this contradiction between the ideal and the real. Does a spring pour forth from the same opening, both fresh and brackish water? Can a fig tree, my brothers and sisters, yield olives? Or a grapevine? Or grapevines, figs? No more can salt water yield fresh water. Pretty powerful image there of what the tongue does and can do. This is one little example here, and I guess I need to call it quits on this. One little example. My dad has been totally blind for 55 years, and he loves to memorize poems. And I mean, all the time, whenever something comes to his mind, he just spits out this poem. Well, we were there. My mom died in December, and we were there for that time, but also just about a month ago we were there. We were at the kitchen table, and we were talking about things, and he spouted off this poem, said, "That reminds me of that." He spouted off this other poem. I thought this other poem, it's a funny little poem, but I think it illustrates quite well that the reality that James talks about, that the tongue cannot be controlled. And maybe you've heard this poem, but here it is in his words.
This was written on a tombstone in a cemetery in Scotland. Beneath this mound of earth and clay lies Clarabel Ellen Young, who, on the 28th day of May, finally began to hold her tongue.
For some, I mean, it's they are unable to control the tongue. But for James, that's a very important demonstration of wisdom. It's a very important demonstration of character development. Okay, I'm bibliography. I'm going to have to just move on here. Sorry. Let me get through this. Let me pass these out. Scott, do you mind?
Yeah.
Doing this right there and over here. Real quick, like here. Some things on the bibliography. My graduate assistant, Stephen Gaines, put some of this this on the first page. There's two sides to it here, okay? A couple things on the first page. You see he has there mine and David Fleer's book. This is it, Preaching Character. I hadn't even thought about it, actually. But the reason to bring it up is because there is a chapter that Scott McKnight has written in this on James, and then several sermons. One sermon by Jonathan Stormett, another one by Chris Smith, another one by Jim Kitchens, and actually another one by Sally Brown. Sally Brown teaches at Princeton, and she wrote a sermon. So that might be a source. The end of that book might be a source for further development on in dealing with this material. Look on the back. Dale Allison, the very first entry there. That is a pretty heavy scholarly work, but if you can kind of work through the Greek, he has really good insights, very good insights. Another one, Luke Timothy Johnson, the New Interpreter's Bible there. You see that about in the middle? That's a good source. He has, after each little section of James, reflections, very practical, insightful reflections. Dan McCartney is a good commentary. Oh, I meant to mention there, Richard Dawkins. Richard Dawkins, some of you may know, is an atheist. Not only an atheist, he is a radical atheist, according to himself. And he has a chapter on the roots of morality, and he talks about our morality and our character. Since James is about character formation, he says that the reason that we act morally is for our own selfish survival. I do not agree, but I think it's something to bring into and dialogue with in light of the book of James. And then down there near the bottom, N.T. Wright, After You Believe. As I said yesterday, I think that that might be another name for the book of James. James assumes you accept the gospel message, you accept Jesus as Lord, you have become a Christian, you've been baptized, he assumes all of that, you believe in the resurrection. So this is after you believe. And this is where he also has that story that I shared, the little video there of Sully, the captain, was it United or Delta, that landed in the U.S. Air? Landed in the
U.S. Air.
Pardon?
I think U.S. Air.
U.S. Air, okay. Landed in the Hudson River. He has that story there. And I think this would be a good supplement for anyone who is working with the book of James. And then finally there, you know, I mentioned yesterday, everybody knows about Martin Luther's statement, you know, that James is a might straw epistle and didn't like it at all. But very few know that he also said on one occasion that he wished he could throw Jimmy in the stove. And I thought that was a very interesting statement. And there's a web link if you want to verify that he actually said that. We're out of time. Any parting comments, thoughts? I really appreciate your attention, your participation, and I hope that your further work and study on James goes well. Thank you.
Thank you.
Oh, and if you do want this PowerPoint, then I would be glad to send it to you. Now, several of you gave me your emails yesterday, and I found out in trying to get them to you that I couldn't read some of them, so I'm sorry. If you do want this, I would like to ask you to email me, and that will be safer. So here's a business card, so if you want to do that, come up and get a business card, and I'll be glad to email it to you, email you a PDF file. The little videos won't come through, but the rest of it will.